on? Norm Shealy. Norm Shealy. You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. John Peterson with the Arlington Institute. How are you, John?
I'm quite well. Thank you, Eva.
So before we get started, tell us a little bit about what the Arlington Institute is and what you do there, and where to find you.
Well, the Arlington Institute is a think tank, a research institute, which I started more than 20 years ago. And TAI is unusual, unique, in that we're futurists, and we study the future, where the world is going, kind of high-level systems analysis of where the world is going. And unlike most people in the futures business who work for a company or something like that and have to focus on a particular discipline like healthcare or economics or something like that. We range very, very widely. We like to think we know a little bit about everything and try to look at kind of from a 30,000-foot perspective. How are all the pieces and how do they fit together and where this is all going? And we're located in Berkeley Springs, West Virginia, which is the eastern panhandle of West Virginia, about 100 miles from Washington, D.C. I started the Arlington Institute in Arlington, Virginia, which is right across the river from Washington, and we moved out here about a year and a half ago. And it's a nice place in the mountains with a quality of life. It's quite nice. But we're a nonprofit. And so what that allows us to do is to chase some very interesting kind of projects that are related to the future of the world in general and where it is all going. We're particularly well known for working in the area of wild cards. One of my books, Out of the Blue, was the first book in English about how to deal with big surprises, how to systematically think about them. What kinds of big surprises might be coming along, and how do you decide which ones are important and such, and things like that. And so we've kind of built a bit of a reputation around big surprises, and in that regard, we built for the government of Singapore a National Surprise Anticipation Center, which is the first capability of its kind in the world, and that's up and running right now. But that's who we are.
What do you mean by big surprises, and what big surprises do you think that humanity, particularly because we're here in the United States, but we do have a worldwide listening audience, but in the United States, what do you think we can expect to see in the next few years, and why do you think that?
Well, surprises,
I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions about that too. So.
Okay. Well, surprises are things you don't anticipate, you don't think about. And to my way of thinking, big surprises are things that I call them wild cards. Are things that they're either so big or they're coming so fast that there isn't any effective way to respond to them. That's the kind of the definition underneath this. That we have surprises all the time, small ones. But what I'm talking about is big kinds of things like 9/11 or something like that that really comes out of the blue, which is the name of the book, of course. And the what I would argue is that we're entering a period of time where the likelihood of these kinds of big surprises is increasing rather dramatically. We're entering a period of time of exponential change where you get more and more change in shorter periods of time. And that change is broadly distributed across all disciplines, so in terms of energy and agriculture for that matter, and climate change and finances and so on, all of these things are undergoing rapid change at the same time. And the intersection between all of these disciplines are places where it's very likely that you get events that show up that nobody anticipated. And so what I think is that we're entering a period of time in the coming years, coming months for that matter, where there are going to be large changes. You want an example of what that might be? I believe that by about August, September of this year, in, 45 to 60 days, that it's likely that the financial system is going to be in free fall. That'll be a series of crises in the global, the U.S. and the global financial system. It'll be clear that it is failing in a rather significant and major way, unlike it ever has before. And for most people, that'll be a surprise. Some of us have been following this for quite some time, and we don't, it's not a surprise to us. And that's the whole idea here, is to try to anticipate, identify and anticipate these kinds of events before they happen.
Well, now I have to ask this question. I wasn't planning on this particular question, but what does the individual do to prepare for that?
Well, there's a variety of things, and the approach is pretty standard. It would be very much the same as if there was a huge hurricane. The imagery that kind of sticks in my mind is if you had one of these satellite photos and you looked down on the Atlantic Ocean and there was one of those hurricane picture shots that, and the hurricane covered the whole Atlantic Ocean. It was a bigger storm than we'd ever seen before. And it was tracking straight ahead so that it was going to hit the East Coast here very soon. And it would very soon be into our little town in West Virginia, just 100 miles away. And so you can anticipate that it is coming, and you would, how would you prepare for it? Well, you'd prepare for it for a financial catastrophe pretty much the same way. You'd try to make sure that you had deal with kind of the necessities, food, water, and stuff like that, in case some parts of the food chain didn't work. And then what you really need to do is start to think about how you would do things differently and what things that you could do that you hadn't done before in terms of either your work or your relationships or other such things, if, in fact, the situation changed and it didn't operate the same way. The kind of the underlying concept that always comes out in these kinds of analysis is one of community. And whether it's a natural disaster of one sort or another, or disruption, or whether it's something like this, that I don't know if you'd call it man-made or not, but in any case, another systemic failure, then the real approach that really works is one of community, getting together, certainly preferably beforehand, with like-minded people who you get along with, and sitting down some evening and saying, what are you going to do, and what are we, I'm going to do, and what will you bring, and what will you bring, and how will we support each other to get through all of this? I mean, that's how you do it. And if there's a disaster, that's how it works out, as a matter of fact, whether you planned it or not. The people who get along after a disaster are the ones who get together with each other and support each other. And so I think that's the basic kind of approach that you need to take.
I'm going to ask you what everybody probably wants to know, and that's, how accurate have you been at predicting things like this?
Well, in general, I don't make predictions. It turns out in this particular case, it's a systemic problem. It's a structural problem, and it's hard. And the questions are, the question in one sense is only about time, whether it shows up sooner or later. But in the past, we've been very accurate in anticipating things like the collapse of the advent of the World Wide Web and what its implications were going to be, and the collapse of the newspaper system. It's been 12 years ago or something, we did a series of workshops with the leadership of publishers and editors from major newspapers, and we laid out exactly what was going to happen, and we went through 6 2-day workshops with them, but we essentially talked about how the internet was going to disintermediate the whole news business, and that anybody could be a publisher like blogs are today, and how that the advertising was going to go off to places like, we didn't know it was Craigslist, but it is Craigslist, and classified advertising would go away, and they were all wondering how in the world they would deal with the internet and the web, because they all had websites, but none of them could make any money and had no idea what in the world they were supposed to be doing. And it was really quite clear that there was going to be just a really big, deep, fundamental change, and it wasn't going to work the same way. So there's a number of things like that.
I can relate. I can't remember when I've looked at the last newspaper. Just not interested. Too outdated, I guess. Okay. What is a paradigm shift, and what are we seeing now but not realizing it as a mass?
Yeah. Well, a paradigm shift is a term that was popularized by Thomas Kuhn, who was a scientist from the University of Chicago. And paradigm shift is a term that describes how one understands reality. Your paradigm is the kind of the logical understanding you have of how things work, how all of the pieces in your environment work. How do your relationships work? How does money work? How does the politics work? If you were parachuted into Borneo, that would be a paradigm shift, because everything would work differently than it works here. And so the notion of a paradigm shift was applied by Kuhn to big shifts in science, to where you have breakthroughs like quantum physics that suddenly redescribes how physics at one level operates compared to Newtonian physics. And so a paradigm shift is almost always multi-leveled, and the shift that we're about to experience here, we believe, is an extraordinary kind of transition in the evolutionary process of the human being, of our species on this planet. You can go back to the beginning of time as we understand it, and when life, even single cellular life, going to multiple cellular life, to vertebrates, to mammals, and so on. And when you work your way through that sequence, and when these different forms of life first showed up, what you find is that there is a regular, almost predictable, kind of cyclical relationship of when these transitions happen. Evolutionary biologists call the whole process punctuated equilibrium. They say there's long periods of equilibrium where you have, say, single cellular life, and then it's punctuated by relatively rapid change, and all of a sudden then we have a new era where it's multiple cellular life and so on. When you look at the pattern, like I say, the cyclical relationship of these things, what you can see is that we're right at a place when we're due for one of these major shifts, when the very description, the paradigm, the way things work fundamentally kind of changes. And in that process, I believe what you get is a new human, and you get a new world. You get a new human that sees the world in quite a different way, and you get a new world that works in quite different ways.
Okay, now my question. Your new book, A Vision for 2012, discusses this paradigm shift, what you think is going to happen. Why do you zero in on 2012?
Well, it's not as exciting an idea as you might think. My publisher asked me if I'd write something that I could give to the next president. This was before the election. That would explain to him how to deal with large-scale change. And so I did send a copy to, a friend took a copy to President Obama. Don't know that he's read it or not, but the idea here was that if your context, if the framework which you're going to live is going to change in really radical, multidimensional kind of ways, then how would you kind of systematically try to think about that? Now, I wrote the book. It has a little bit of a government flavor to the thing, but it's designed so it's the principles are useful, whether it's for a family or for you as an individual or for a company, for that matter. The principles are exactly the same. And what we did was try to say, look, here are all the big trends that are coming, and here are the changes that I call them breakdowns and breakthroughs, big positive things that are on the way, huge kind of changes in computer capability and biotechnology and such. And these things are all colliding together, and they could generate, you know, a number of possible scenarios. And we give paint pictures of alternative worlds that could come out of this and then say, well, there's one of these that's a lot better than the other one, and if you wanted that one to show up, then how would you start to approach your life and what you do in a different way in order to deal with and help to make sure that that world shows up? And so it's all about trying to deal with big change, and 2012 is the end of the first administration, and that's why we kind of fixated on 2012, although I was happy to maybe trade on all of the interest that there is in the Mayan calendar and other kinds of things that are related to 2012.
Well, I don't know what I think about all those things. I mean, some of the, you know, I get all these books from people that want to come on my show, and when I see that number, I flip through some of them, and some of them are ridiculous, and I flip through yours, and it was amazing. So it made me wonder if it was just a synchronistic thing, if it was a conscious choice, or if you thought oil was going to run out by then, you know, like Lester Brown, his tables that he does about natural resources, he kind of focuses on that date. So I didn't know if there was something important. But
well, it well may be. The interesting thing about these kinds of shifts, if you will, is that you get a world, a new world, that operates fundamentally differently than the previous one. It does not operate in the same way. That's the essential nature of a paradigm shift, is that it in one sense it doesn't make sense in the previous era. I mean, I like to tell the story suggest that if you were a monk in 1460 and you were in some drafty cold a monastery that was lit by candles, and you were sitting there along with rows and rows of other monks, and you were hand-writing out manuscripts and doing illumination of the Bible and duplications of this thing. And you suddenly had this extraordinary dream one night, and you woke up in the morning in a cold sweat, and you said, my, there's big change coming downstream. I just know it is. And you walked around to everybody that was an expert around there, to the abbot or to the, you know, the Monsignor or the Cardinal or whoever all of these folks were, and you said, you know, what do you think is coming? What is it going to be? It would be impossible. There would be no way in the world that any one of them could say, well, in 2 years or so, this guy Gutenberg is going to invent movable type, and it's going to change fundamentally the way that human beings communicate ideas and proliferate ideas. And by the way, it's going to just ravage the Catholic Church and destroy all of our infrastructure in the northern Europe. And it's going to, you know, produce all of these huge kind of changes and problems and ultimately t- turn into the industrial age. I mean, it's just no way in the world. There's just a person would look around themselves and at everything they saw, and they'd say, well, it'd probably be some variation of what we already understand.
Right.
That's the problem here. It's going to be different.
Don't know what you don't know.
No, okay. but you can if you're open to all of this. You see, it doesn't just show up. I think it starts to percolate. That these ideas start to surface in different ways, and new ideas about how the economy works, and new ideas about how consciousness works, and new ideas about cosmology, and how, you know, and all of these kinds of things. And if you're open to that, if you're permeable and you'll let these ideas through, if you understand that the new world, by definition, isn't going to work like the old world, and therefore there are things that haven't been, that don't make sense in this reality, that will make real sense in the coming reality, then I think you can start to frame, you can start to build, this is one of the projects we want to do at my institute, you start to build a little bit of a model about how this new world might work. But it's possible. I mean, I don't think it's all going to be a big surprise to all of us.
I'm going to save about 10 minutes at the end of this show where we can talk about consciousness and intention.
Sure.
And how you think the change will be in that perspective, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't want us to forget to talk about that.
Okay.
In the meantime, I have a bunch of questions just about your typical work that you do, like we've been talking about. But I want to go to that conscious perspective before we hang up.
Okay.
Do you think we'll have a new currency?
Well, it's a distinct possibility. There are indications that suggest that the huge amount of money that's been put into the system and the huge amount of money that's going to be required, the U.S. government is running somewhere between, I've seen estimates, between $2 and $3 trillion in the red in operating terms this year. Now, business taxes are down something like 64% compared to last year because of the recession. And for individual income tax, it's about 35% or something like that. And so
Wow. What
you have is huge decreases in the amount of money that the government takes in. And at the same time, the budget, the costs of running the government, continues, if not growing. And the difference is at least $2 trillion, and they think that when you add it all up by the end of the year, it'll be about $3 trillion. And they have to make that up some way. And the way they make it up is they go to the market with treasury bills, and they sell them to foreign countries like China and other such things. And the problem is that the Chinese have made it quite clear that they're not going to buy this stuff in the future the way they have in the past. And the Chinese have already gotten together with the Brazilians to try to talk about, and then they had a meeting of 8 countries and that they wouldn't allow the United States in to talk about, among other things, an alternative currency to the dollar as a standard currency. And so what you have here is setting up the possibility that the United States needs to raise money. It goes to market. Nobody wants to buy the money. No one wants to buy the T-bills. And what happens is then the only way to do that is the Federal Reserve has got to buy the T-bills. And how does the Federal Reserve do the T-bills? Because they print money, and so they make... And so what you end up is a flooding of a huge amount of money into the system, which inevitably has got to turn into inflation. In this particular case, probably hyperinflation is what increasing number of analysts are talking about. So if you have hyperinflation, what ends up being is that the dollar gets worth less and less and less. It also gets worth less and less because more and more countries and other companies and everything flee away from it because they see it's becoming decreasing in terms of its value. And so what you have, you set up, is a huge kind of problem. As it decreases in value, of course, then it doesn't buy as much, and that exacerbates the problem with the government. So what it looks like is the government's going to have to start shutting down pieces of the government later this year. That's my guess. Probably starting with NASA or other agencies that we would rather not live without, but we can live without. And when all of this kind of ball starts rolling, this snowball starts to rolling, is that everybody starts to realize that this isn't going to get fixed anytime soon, that the stimulus really isn't working as fast as it is, that people are losing confidence in the system. And then there's the derivatives. There's about a minimum of $600 trillion worth of derivatives, financial instruments that are in the system that are all just propped up by confidence.
So I have a question here.
Mm-hmm.
The people that have money, say, in, you know, that all the people that had money in retirements, you know, lost it. So what's left in people's savings accounts, people's retirement accounts, what do? Do they take it out and get gold or silver, or what do they
protect in the next
60 days like you were talking about?
Well, that's the basic idea is right. What you want to do in a time of inflation like that is you want to quickly invest your money into something that's tangible, that will hold its value. And when I say hold its value, what you essentially want is something that is commodity-like. That is to say, it's something that everybody's going to need. So if you decided to take your money out of the stock market, which I think you really ought to do, I mean, I'm not giving advice to anybody because I'm not legally able to do that, but all I can tell you is that I sure took my money out of the market. But what you would want to do if you decided to put it into real estate is that you'd put it into, I would think, something like kind of mid to lower level rental properties, because people are always going to have to live somewhere. And if they can't buy a house or something, then they'll need to rent a house. I mean, you wouldn't put it in high-end condos because that's not commodity. Like, there isn't always going to be a demand for those kinds of things. And so that commodity-like tangible entity could well be gold or silver, or it could be a market basket of... some people are putting it into foreign currencies. There's a variety of things in the short term, how to ride this down and maybe even make money on the whole thing. But in the end, what you wanted before, your question was, is there going to be a new currency? And the question is that if there is a scenario that if this gets really bad, that sometime next year, maybe in the first half of next year sometime, that the government would decide to switch to another currency, swap out dollars at a nickel on a dollar or something like that, and that would be the bad time to be holding on to dollar bills or dollar bill equivalents. And so what you really want to do is to try to get into something. The folks here in West Virginia say cigarettes and whiskey, you know. You can always trade those out, and they always maintain their value. So
I don't know.
Okay. Oh, I'm kind of... That's kind of frightening. I mean, I didn't realize that you expected change so soon, that drastic. All right. My next question is, Nicholas Stern said humanity has 10 years before the shift is unrecoverable. 10 years from when? And do the people even, on a mass level, get that there's a shift? Are governments listening to you? Are authority figures listening to your institute? Do they get it?
Well, there's two kind of messages here that you're talking about. Sir Nicholas is dealing with climate change. In particular,
okay,
he thinks it's global warming. And I take issue with him. I mean, and mine is a minority position, but it's growing. And it's growing significantly because the models that the IPCC, International I forget what they what those little letter, the acronym stands for, but the climate change. International UN Group on Climate Change, they based all of their theories and their projections on models that are relatively simplistic. That is to say that we're at the early stage of trying to make sense out of very, very complex global climate systems, and we can't even begin to effectively model it. And so I know some of the scientists who have some of those models, and they're convinced that it all gets so hot that by 2030 that humans start dying on the planet and such. Well, I don't think that's the case. There are plenty of there's a number of indicators that suggest, in fact, that we're at the beginning of kind of an oscillation, instability in the climate that will probably in 5 to 7 years turn into a mini ice age, a very cold period. And so in any case, what you've got is instability and uncertainty in terms of the climate. And that, of course, has far more significance than just that you're going to have to either wear different clothes than you wear now, because it all backs into agriculture and the ability to grow food in the same places where it's grown before because of climate changes and so on. And so it's a big deal either way, whether it gets hot or whether it gets cold.
Mm-hmm.
But
do you one question, then I want to go into the intention and the consciousness. How much oil do you think is left? How much use do you think we have left? I mean, sometimes I wonder if it weren't consciousness contributing to what's going on right now. So there had to be some kind of crash so people could, since we're not inclement to change, we have no choice now but to move energy systems with cars.
Well, it's more than that. We've literally hit the peak in the amount of oil that's in the system. We're not run out of oil, per se. You just pump less and less every year. All through our lives, Eva, your life and mine and everybody that's listening to this program, we've essentially had year after year of increased pumping and availability of oil. It's gone up dramatically year after year after year. The demand has grown substantially. And the supply has grown substantially until 3 years ago when it flattened out for the first time, and it flattened out rather dramatically. It just fell off. And it's almost certain that this year or in the next 12 months or something like that, it is going to start to head down. And it's kind of like having hit the halfway point in terms of the amount of oil that's in the ground, and from now on we're producing less and less of it because it costs more and more. There are a number of senior executives in the oil industry that are now come to the conclusion that they're never going to be able to pump as much oil as they've pumped in the past, and in fact, it'll be less and less. And so the problem with that is that when the supply decreases, the demand doesn't. And so in places like China and India and others, but particularly in China, they have a increasing demand because of all of their economy is growing, and they have all these people that they have to keep happy and that they have to keep encouraging and have hope in the economy. And if they can't provide for cars and other kinds of things, then they have big domestic kind of problems. And it probably turns into, it necessarily turns into shortages in terms of the amount of oil that's available, but also the price will go up. Right now it's estimated that many of the oil-producing countries are operating below water. Their costs are higher than what the prices are. I mean, at least when it was about $60 a barrel. And so they have all the incentives in the world to try to get the price back up. And if you couple that with a decreasing value of the dollar in the in the coming months, then if that in fact happens the way it appears that it might, then in fact that necessarily drives the price of oil up higher and higher. And so any way you look at it, this is a fundamental kind of transition in the whole petroleum era. We are at the beginning of the end of the age of petroleum. And that's important because everything you see when you look around inside of a building is a byproduct of petroleum in one way or another, either for transportation or manufacturing or whatever it is. And so our whole standard of living, our way of life, is a product of the petroleum that we've used. And when you don't have petroleum, then what you have to do is very rapidly switch over to some alternative kinds of energy. And the problem is that you can't get there fast enough. There's no way that anybody has found in trying to think about this where you can build up another kind of infrastructure, an alternative infrastructure, fast enough to offset the decrease in the amount of oil that's being pumped. The assumption is that the amount of oil that would decrease would be decreasing at about 5% a year. Well, you don't have to be a mathematician to figure out that over, say, 5 years, that's 25% less oil, or thereabouts, which means that you take a quarter of the oil out of the system in 5 years. And there's no country, including the United States, that can't continue to operate in the same way they have before if you make those kinds of changes that fast.
Yes, that's all I can say. Yes. All right. I want you. Oh, one more question before we move. We got about 23 minutes.
Okay.
So I want to ask you before we get on to the other topic is, do you think we're going to have food shortages in the rich countries? And if so, do you think it'll be, how long a period of time are we looking at?
It's pretty reasonable to presume that there will be disruptions of supply chains. Right now, in the agriculture and other places, they talk about the 1,500-mile salad. On the average, the lettuce and the other components of your salad travel 1,500 miles to get from you. They're not grown locally. And so there's all kinds of places in that supply chain, from the farmer in California in the Central Valley or Salinas Valley who's growing this stuff, all the way to getting it to you. There's a lot of places in that supply chain when somebody might not, because of the economy, problems with the economy, might not be able to do what they were supposed to do, and you don't end up with tomatoes or whatever it is that you wanted in your salad. And that problem exists broadly across the whole economic system. There are, and any place that the supply chain breaks down, then it kind of reverberates through the system, typically. And there are any number of materials, whether they're commodities or other kinds of materials, that might not show up as much as they have in the past, and then manufacturing companies won't be able to manufacture as much as they have in the past, and that'll slow some things down. And anyway, it's a big, big, very complex, interconnected system. And you cannot jerk a whole lot of petroleum, which is mostly used for transportation, out of the system and not have it bounce around, the effects bounce around all over the system. And so it's likely that there will be disruptions of one sort or another, I don't know what kind, in terms of food. That could translate into shortages in your terminology. And that's why there are marvelous movements growing up all over the world around localization, around sourcing food and other kinds of things locally. I like to say that if you think there are a whole lot of people who think that their food comes from the supermarket, and they're going to be really surprised here if they, when they find out that they don't know a farmer and they don't have any place to get food because that's not where it comes from. It comes from farmers, and so it's a really good time to get to know a farmer, I think, or a local farmer, or a farmer's market or some other kind of thing. So there's a great kind of move, a huge kind of increase in interest in local supply of restaurants buying food locally, supplying their food locally, and produce and things, and also for farmers markets and other such things, as well as other sourcing of things locally. And so there are ways around this. Clearly, you don't have to buy your salad from California. But it's going to take some changing, and the change is already in the works, and there are a number of organizations, and if you go on the web, you find all kinds of things about how to deal with and think about this kind of stuff.
Speaking of the web, you have a very good website that has a lot of information. It's arlingtoninstitute.org, right?
That's it, arlingtoninstitute.org.
Okay, now I'd like for you to talk about...
Let me also mention that we produce a newsletter that's going to start up here again every 2 weeks. And what we do is survey, and we go across the horizon looking for little bits and articles of interest that we think are early indicators and weak signals that point toward significant things that could be happening downstream. And lots of folks think it's the best newsletter in the world for giving you indications of what might be coming. And it's free, and you can sign up for that at the website.
Okay. Now, you told me that you had been working on a new project. Tell me about that project.
Well, like I said earlier, I think that if you are really in the middle of this paradigm shift in the way that it appears to be, if you're in the middle of a punctuation in the equilibrium and that you're at an evolutionary jump for humanity, what you're going to get is humans that come out of this thing that operate in a different way. They see the world differently. In kind of simplistic terms, you could certainly say that coming out of a big disruption like this, you would be interested in sustainability and resilience and things like that, and that would be very important, and everything you did would be oriented toward that. But more than that, what it looks like, and you see this kind of bubbling up lots of different kind of places, is that there is an increasing interest in what some people call oneness, the notion that we're all connected to each other in one way or another. And that then translates into cooperation rather than competition. And so we don't have the time here to go into it, but there's lots of examples of how businesses are working with each other differently and so on that all reflect a movement toward cooperation rather than competition, and that perhaps would become the central kind of prism lens through which you would see this new world as an individual. But also there's a new world that shows up. There's a different economy, and there's a different government system, and there's but different legal and education and agriculture and all these kinds of things, because if you see the world differently, if you see the world through a different lens, then you're going to do things differently, and your institutions are going to change. And so at the Arlington Institute here, we're interested in trying to anticipate and think about what that new world might be and start to build a simple initial model of what that world might be, so that we can start a discussion, we can start a debate about what, but you could at least stick a stake in the ground, what I call it a logical seed, that you can plant a seed of what, in practical terms, what this world might look like or how it might work, that would allow people to start a debate and say, yeah, well, it ought to be green, it shouldn't be blue, you know, but it kind of makes sense, and you could start the discussion about and engage people in design and essentially working out the design of what this new world might look like. And in time, you'd work that over into, like I say, government and education and other things, and and start so that you could evolve. What we're trying to do here is to catalyze an evolutionary process and an emergent kind of process and get a whole lot of people started to talk about what this new world might look like and how you get from here to there. But it all has to start with some little idea, some concrete idea. And so it's not enough to say, oh, we want peace and we all ought to meditate or we all ought to be loving and all those kinds of good things. But those are really soft and they don't talk concrete terms how things would operate. And that's important as well. And so what we need to start is doing that. And that's a project I'm trying to get funded right now.
You know what I've always thought about, well, ever since I've had an interest in consciousness, is I think that we ought to, I don't know how to say this, that we ought to govern ourselves with elders, because elders aren't interested in warring, they're not interested in fighting, they're interested in feeding their tribes and resolving conflict. So I wonder why no one ever thinks about using elders in society.
Well, I think in some communities that is, certainly, in lots of communities, that's the case. But in this country, at least, the older the trends are that the older people get, the more conservative they get, and the more conservative they get is the more defensive and more willing they are to. I mean, this is certainly the case in the United States, and it's supported by all kinds of examples and research, is that they're willing to start these stupid wars and do all kinds of crazy things that that other people might not.
Yeah, I guess you're right. I was just thinking about, you know, tribal communities, not necessarily in Africa or wherever, but where people stick close and don't
sure.
say my kid didn't do that and
yeah, right.
Or whatever. Anyway, so what would be the first thing that you would do to implement such a plan?
Well,
you gotta get somebody to listen.
It's a good question. And the thing about this is that it's got to make sense, right? I mean, if I hold up this little thing in my hand, I've branded it. Let me call it New World, okay? So I hold this thing up in front of your face, and I say, look it, I got this idea for a new world. If you looked at it and said, that's kind of interesting, but how does it work? Then I would have failed. Because if it isn't obvious how it works, if it isn't clear that this is, you know, what you need to do is have people look at this thing and say, wow, yeah, that's a neat idea. That could work. That'd be a lot better place. I could do something with that. You know, it has to be that level of telegraphic, you know, character, that you see it and almost instantaneously you say, yeah, that works, that makes sense.
I have something I have to ask you here. You know, consciousness is in gradients, you know, like David Hawkins' work.
Yep.
People can't, and I'm not trying to be devil's advocate or anything, it's just that I find when I try to talk to people in my field, which is law, they cannot it. They don't even believe it.
I understand.
So how do you get those people, present those people with a picture that they can't even grasp?
Well, I'll tell you. First of all, it's got to be logical and it has to work. So I think that there's no way to do this without starting with a group of smart people. And my plan is to and I've thought about this for many, many years and refined this and thought through different kind of approaches, but do a couple of three-day workshops with some really unusual folks from around the world and build the basic kind of architecture of what this little very simple kind of model might look like. And then you go off and you get a brand and take it to a design firm and you brand it and you build some nice graphics and you distill down a description so I could rapidly describe this to you. An elevator speech, you know how elevator
mm-hmm.
speeches go. And so that I could hold this up and say, look, it's this, and you say, yeah, that could work. And so now that's the basis for the discussion. So now I plant that. And I'm working with some very interesting people who have the notion They have some gaming technology for the web. And what we're interested in doing is planting this in the middle of this gaming environment where people have an incentive and it's fun to try to solve problems around this basic concept and to embellish the concept and to question the concept and to color it and do whatever it is, but to get a bunch of people involved in the thing. Now, let me tell you, the only ones who are going to show up are the ones who are interested in it. So it's going to be self-selective. I mean, these things always start with small numbers of people who are interested in the subjects and who have an affinity for it all. And so there's no time in this whole process where you are trying to sell Coca-Cola to the masses here. This is a specialty product that only certain kinds of people are going to be interested in. But let me tell you, you don't need many of those people to get interested in this before the whole system changes. The best estimates are that you only need about 1% of the population to change their mind in these fundamental kind of ways, and in ways that I don't understand, and certainly I've not read anything about anyone who understands, but there's a lot of examples of it, that the whole system changes. It flips. Now, it might have to do with consciousness. It almost certainly has to do with consciousness and other things that are happening in other dimensions and other areas, I suppose, but in any case, it doesn't take a lot of people. And so the objective here is to try to aggregate, provide an environment where that's enough fun and has enough incentive that people can come together and they can start to build amongst themselves this new world, between and amongst themselves, and they can all participate and try. And that technology is available to do that right now.
I'm just curious. I'm sorry, go ahead.
And you could work out into these different kind of domains, so in terms of education and government and other kinds of things, and you could start to say, how should this thing work? All of which trying to make sure that it's compatible with and the core concepts and the core kind of principles about that drives this new world. And so if you get enough people that are involved in that thing, not only do you get resilient, you get internal resilience to the whole idea because people have all tried it and shot at it from a whole lot of directions, but what you also get is you get a constituent group. You get a whole bunch of people who have played and been involved in this thing, and they understand how it works and they like the idea. So when the old system collapses or becomes dysfunctional, and all the regular guys start looking around and saying, "Golly, what are we going to do now?" Then it'll be really quite obvious that, well, there's an alternative, and it's been kind of tested and it's worked on, and a lot of people know about it, and here's an alternative. There's a new world.
If you get some kind of gaming thing, we've only got a couple minutes, but if you get some kind of gaming thing, will it be something done online or will you have a CD? The reason
it'd be online.
If you have something online, that might be something that we could put on our radio site. You know,
well,
we get a lot of traffic.
It'll be a little while, and I'll come back and see you, and we can do
that. Yeah, do that, because we get probably 3 or 4 million hits a day on that site. So,
yeah.
Do you ever work with Irvin Laszlo?
Well, I don't know. I've certainly read all of his stuff. We have a lot of mutual friends, but I've not met Mr. Laszlo. But I'm very sympathetic to his ideas.
Yeah, I do. Okay, we got about 2 minutes left. If you want to, I could ask you a million other questions about epidemics and wars and. But I think they should just go read your book and go to your website.
Well, the book is a good place to start because the book lays a framework for how to think about this in a logical kind of way to say, you know, if the world's going to change in much bigger ways than anyone alive has any experience with, we have no tools and other kinds of things, then what you need is an organized way in which to start to get your arms around that and a checklist almost about, how do you approach these kinds of things? How do you determine what major decisions in your life, whether they're going to be compatible with all of this change or whether they contribute to it all? And so It's a very useful. It's a small book. It's only a, you know, I don't know, 120 pages or something like that. But folks who read it, I get lots of very warm and responses from people saying how helpful it's been.
It's a great handbook. It really is. It really is. So we can find you at arlingtoninstitute.org.
That's it.
And is there an email address? People
sure, John P., that's me, John P. at arlingtoninstitute.org.
All right, John, thank you so much for coming on. I wish I had another couple of hours because you have so many topics to cover, but I think if they'll just get a hold of your book, they'll have all their questions answered, or at least start them in place to think. Thank you for coming on, and I hope you'll come back.
Thank you. Nice to be with you, Eva.
Good night.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health.
Integral Health.
Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health.
Consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m.
7 p.m.
to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.